It's not very often that we look at the Song of Solomon, well, the whole book anyway. I know there are those occasions when we have devotions in certain selected passages, but it's not very often that we get the chance to go through the whole book. Well, that's what we're going to do in these two studies, and I trust that you'll find that our studies are very suited to the occasion and the audience that we have assembled here. They're just going to be two brief studies, perhaps 25 minutes or so apiece. And in the course of those two studies, I want to go through the whole of this book. I want to consider the excitement of love, which is roughly the way I have summarized the contents of the first half, and then the discipline of love, which is the way I have summarized the second half. However, before we go any further, we must get a little bit of orientation to the book. The very first verse tells us that it is the Song of Songs, and it is Solomon's, from which we gather that Solomon is the author of this book. And from our knowledge of Solomon, from the Book of Kings, we gather that he's a very appropriate person to write a book such as this, because he was a great poet and songwriter, and he was also a great lover, using the word lover in a fairly broad sense, a very worldly sense, you might say. You know the story of Solomon? He was a wise man, and in 1 Kings chapter 4, we are told that he wrote over 3,000 proverbs, that is, he either wrote them or collected them, 3,000 proverbs, and over 1,000 songs. A great poet, a great songwriter. And a few chapters further over, we are told that he was also a great lover in the sense that he accumulated many women, 700 wives and princes, and 300 concubines. Not to be wondered at that the name of Solomon is so readily associated with the Song of Songs, which is a collection of poems, specifically a collection of love songs. Now, just because Solomon was the writer of the book, it doesn't mean to say that Solomon is the chief character in the book, and I believe that that's one of the areas where we frequently go wrong. A lot of people look at the book and they're trying to work out which person is Solomon, and most interpretations take it for granted that Solomon is one of the people talked about in the story. I don't believe that that is the case. Most poems are not about the person who writes them, particularly ballads and love songs. The person is writing about someone else. Very rarely does the person write about himself. And if Solomon wrote this poem, I don't think we're to assume simply because he wrote it that he wrote it about himself. I don't believe that Solomon is the chief character in the book, nor do I believe that the poem is about him personally. Well, who is it about? That's a good question, because as you read different versions of the Bible, read different books and listen to different preachers, you very soon become aware of the fact that there are many interpretations in the Song of Songs, or many interpretations of the Song of Songs. It's very difficult to work out who speaks where. As you read the book through, sometimes it's me and I, then the next it's you, and then it's they, then it's him or her and somebody else, and it's quite a job working out who is speaking where. Some of the modern versions, such as the Good News Bible and the New International Version, have helped us along by putting a comment as to who is the speaker in the different sections. Now, that's extremely helpful, provided, of course, we agree with the interpretation of the person who put those designations there. I believe that the Good News Bible and the New International Version on the whole are fairly close to what would be a correct interpretation of the book. I'll go along with most of their designations. There are a few places where we're going to disagree, but on the whole I think they're quite helpful. The King James Version also has a few comments, and of course it simply spiritualizes the book away and applies everything to Christ in the church, which may of course present us with some nice devotional thoughts, but quite frankly it's got nothing to do with what Solomon was talking about. The book is a collection of love poems, and I believe we should forget about this spiritualizing the meaning away into some New Testament type interpretation. Forget about that for the time being, and simply concentrate on understanding what was the message originally intended by the man when he wrote. What was he talking about? Who was he talking to? As you read the book through, you find there are dialogues, there are dreams. People sometimes recall the past, sometimes they look to the future. Sometimes they are simply writing down a refreshing or an erotic or even a disturbing dream that he or she might have had. All sorts of things here in the book. And trying to sort them all out is not very easy. As a result, people have come up with different interpretations concerning how many characters are involved in the story. Now, some people would say there are three characters in the story. There's a shepherd and his girlfriend, his lover, the girl that he's betrothed to. And then along comes our lusty King Solomon, who's already got a fairly well-fitted-out harem, and he takes this attractive girl from the country and brings her to Jerusalem and puts her into the harem. She, meanwhile, is still loving her distant lover, he is still loving her, and she is very much resistant to the advances of Solomon there in the palace, because her love is loyal to her shepherd lover. So there are three characters. Now that makes quite a good story, but it doesn't appear to me to be a likely interpretation. Certainly one has to push and force some of the passages a fair bit to make them fit. Although I must admit that no matter what interpretation you take, you've got to force some passages a little bit. Nothing seems to really fit exactly. But I don't believe that the story is a drama. That's what I'm getting around to saying. I don't believe that we have here a drama in poetic form. And certainly, I don't think that a song could be called the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's, when Solomon turns out to be the villain of the story. I can hardly imagine a king such as Solomon writing a song like this if he's the villain of the piece. There is an alternative view which says there are two lovers, one of them Solomon, and one of them one of his lovers, a woman who is genuinely in love with him and he genuinely in love with her. Again, I don't believe that the interpretation fits, particularly with all the pastoral scenes. Whatever else you might learn about Solomon, you certainly don't get the impression anywhere that he was greatly interested in farming activities. He was a builder, he was a man of the city, and the whole of his life seems to have been spent in beautifying Jerusalem, in constructing great building projects in Jerusalem and in the country areas. He was not the pastoral figure. And apart from that, I just don't believe that the meaning fits very well. My approach is this. I see the book as a collection of love songs. And the figures involved throughout are the same two people, a shepherd and his beloved. A young man and a young lady who are deeply in love and who are looking forward to the day of their marriage. Yet there is a unity in the whole book. Although it's a collection of love songs, it's not a random collection, it's not miscellaneous and disjointed. There's a unity and there's also a progression. At the beginning, the lovers are distant. I mean distant in mileage, I don't mean in spirit. They're separated from each other. It's still their courting days, that's what I'm saying. It's still their courting days. But as you move through, you're definitely getting closer and closer to the wedding day, and it may even be that in the last chapter they are in fact married. Where along the road they actually get married is difficult to say. And so it's rather difficult to interpret some of these poems as to whether they are married or whether they aren't. But it does look pretty obvious to me that at the beginning they're not married and at the end they are married. The book says a lot about sexual love, and I believe that's one of the great advantages of the book. One of the great values is to show us that sexual love is not something to be ashamed of. It's not something we're to feel guilty about. It is part of the natural relationship which God desires between the sexes. God approves of it. Even erotic love God approves of. That is part of the instinct that he has given in man and woman. But always, and this is the important point, always this erotic love, this expression of love, the physical expression of love, always it is in the context of a total relationship to the exclusion of all others and a total commitment of each to the other. Now that is very strong in the book. And if we come out with nothing more than that, then I think we've been reminded of an important element which is too often neglected in our society today, where, as we realise, people treat sexual love as something that's to be taken very lightly, taken for granted, and there's not much sense of commitment. People seem to bounce from one house to the next, and sexual relations, they don't have any more morality in this issue than they do in deciding whether they're going to change jobs or whether they're going to go and play squash tonight or go down the bowling alley. It's as free as that at times. Well, here the Song of Solomon is telling us that there is an excitement of love and it's something to thrill to, but there's also a discipline of love. And the commitment of each other in sexual love is a commitment which is exclusive to each other exclusive of everybody else. Now, some of these statements here are a bit embarrassing when you read them. We're not used to reading this sort of thing in the Bible, and that's why very often we skip over some of the more embarrassing sections when we're reading, publicly anyway. And, of course, the expressions are very extravagant, quite ridiculous at times, but then lovers do tend to use ridiculous language when they're talking about each other, talking to each other. The figures of speech are very, very strange indeed, but then some of ours are, aren't they, when you think of it? We talk about honey. People address each other as honey, which is a bit odd when you think of it. Someone is a peach, or somebody has cheeks like rosy apples, which is not all that complimentary when you think of it. Well, so it is when you read here, you find there are references to eyes like doves, hair like a flock of goats, a nose like the Tower of Damascus, which doesn't impress us greatly. But it was something which must have meant a lot to those people, and it was within the context of their own environment. Noses, incidentally, are very odd things, as we've all observed. And it's interesting to see how, in some places, they like a prominent and stately nose, whereas in other places, for example in Asia, among the East Asians anyway, the Chinese types, the Thai people where I come from, they rather like their flat nose and not in the least envious of our rather prominent beaks sitting out there in the front of our faces. But here, among the Middle Eastern people, where the nose is a much more prominent feature of the face, we find that we have an odd simile, an odd picture presented. Well, so it goes on. Different people have different ways of expressing themselves, and as long as we can realise that we're all a bit odd when we're being extravagant in our language, well, once we can adjust to that, then I'm sure that we can make the necessary cultural allowances here and understand what the book's about. Okay, let's get into it now. I'm going to go through the first four chapters and finish with the opening verse of chapter 5. I'm going to just read through, not every single verse, but read through some of the main verses, and all I want you to do is to get into the spirit of the book, capture something of the atmosphere, and see what we can learn from it. Firstly, we have a longing for a distant lover, in verses 2 to 7. The woman is speaking throughout the whole of this song, verses 2 to 7. "Oh, that you would kiss me with the kisses of your mouth," she says. "For your love is better than wine, your anointing oils are fragrant, your name is oil poured forth, and therefore the maidens love you." You see, she imagines that her handsome young man is so handsome that all the maidens would have to love him. And I think that's a feeling which lovers quite often have for each other. We wonder, if our beloved is as beautiful and as attractive as we think she is, we wonder why it is that everybody doesn't have the same evaluation. So she has this feeling towards her lover. "Draw me then," she says in verse 4, "draw me after you, let us make haste. The king has brought me into his chambers." That's one of those references, of course, which causes people to think all the time of Solomon. But this expression whereby lovers refer to each other as the king and the queen is as old as love itself. It's a natural way for lovers to refer to each other. I can remember in my youth some of the songs that used to be sung when I was at school about "you will be my queen and she will be my queen," lovers expressing this love for each other. In fact, I heard a song only recently on the TV one night where again the same expressions were there. It's a very common type of expression between lovers. So, she pictures her lover as her king, and to her he is king, and she imagines now that he takes her into his bedchamber. "We will exult and rejoice in you, and we will extol your love more than wine, and rightly do they love you," she says. Surely such a handsome man, everybody must admire him. However, she's a little concerned over the fact that she's rather swarthy, because she's been working out in the sun. She's a farm girl, and the men of the Middle East much preferred fair-skinned girls. Isn't it amazing how none of us are really satisfied with the way we are? We found the same in Thailand, and I've spoken with other people from different countries in Asia, and they've said the same thing, that the people like the girls who are fair-skinned, or more fair-skinned. Their skin tends to be darker than ours. One of the requirements of beauty is that the person be fair-skinned. Now, we, of course, already have fair skin, so everybody is lying out in the sun, getting themselves tanned to make themselves look darker. So here we have light-coloured skin, people wanting to be darker, and darker-coloured wanting to be lighter. Well, that's the way this girl feels. She feels a little embarrassed over the fact that she's sunburnt, because her brothers have made her work out in the fields, and she's not as fair-skinned as some of the other ladies around Jerusalem. Do not gaze at me because I'm swarthy. I'm in verse 6 now. Because the sun has scorched me. My mother's sons were angry with me, and they made me keeper of the vineyards. They made me work out in the sun all day. But my own vineyard I have not kept. My own appearance, I haven't been able to devote the attention to it that some other ladies might. Tell me, you whom my soul loves, where you pasture your flock. Her lover was a shepherd, and he was out somewhere looking after his flock. She wants to know where he is so that she can go flying to him and there rejoice for a few moments in the presence of him who is her lover. And so there is the opening poem, which sets the tone for the rest of the book. We come then to the second part, which really follows on from this first little song, and it is a conversation, real or imagined, nevertheless it's a conversation between the man and the lady. It starts in chapter 1, verse 8, and it goes through to chapter 2, verse 7. I believe that it is intended to follow on from what we've just had in the opening seven verses. Because in those verses, the woman has expressed her longing for her absent lover, and now her absent lover responds by inviting her to come and join him where he is in the fields. Verse 8. She has already said in verse 7, tell me where you are. So in verse 8 he says, if you do not know, O fairest among women, then follow in the tracks of the flock and pasture your kids beside the shepherd's tents. Just follow the tracks, and you'll soon find me, because I'm out here in the fields looking after my sheep. And then he goes off to praise her beauty. I compare you, my love, to a mare of Pharaoh's chariots. Now there's one of those cases that strikes us as being a little odd. Not many of our women folk would feel flattered if we praise them in such terms. But I should imagine that different things affect different people in different ways. One of the terms of endearment we have in Thailand, for example, is a mouse, to refer to a person as a mouse. That again strikes us here as being a little odd, but it's a very natural expression for them, and it doesn't convey to their minds the sort of thing it might convey to ours. Likewise, I suppose here, by comparing her to a mare of Pharaoh's chariots. Mind you, there are horse lovers among us who know the finer features of animals. Perhaps they can identify a bit more with this type of expression. It goes on, her cheeks, her neck, and so he describes her beauty. The woman responds, the man responds, and so you get this talk going through the rest of the chapter. In the opening verse of chapter 2, the woman says in effect that she's nothing special. She says, I'm just a rose of Sharon, I'm just a lily of the valleys. In saying that, she is saying that she's just an ordinary thing. I know that we have hymns which praise Jesus Christ as being the lily of the valley, as if he's the most beautiful thing. But that is not the meaning here, it's the other way around. She says, look, I'm simply a lily of the valley, just an ordinary old wild flower that grows anywhere. I suppose the equivalent we might have today would be a dandelion. I'm just an ordinary flower, just a dandelion that grows out in the field somewhere. A rose of Sharon means, again, just an ordinary old wildflower that you can find anywhere out in the fields. I'm nothing special, she says. What does the man say in verse 2? Compared with you, he says, all the others are like brambles. You might think you're only a dandelion, but, he says, you're like a dandelion among brambles. Compare you with the rest of them, and they're just dry old sticks. So is my love among the maidens. Whereupon the lady responds in verse 3 by saying, as an apple tree among the trees of the wood, so is my beloved among young men. He praised her, so she praises him. He says that she's better than the rest, and she says to him, yes, and you're better than the rest too. And to be with him is a feast of joy and love. With great delight, I sat in his shadow. I sat down under this beautiful tree. She just rejoices in his presence. And as she gets carried away with this feeling of love, she says in verse 7, look, you daughters of Jerusalem, you easily excitable maidens around town, I adjure you by the gazelles or the hinds of the field that you do not stir up nor awaken love until it please. There's no need to excite me, she says, I'm excited enough naturally. Don't stir me on. Love will stir itself in its own good time. And she's having enough trouble controlling her feelings without being excited by the urging on of some of these rather scatterbrained women around Jerusalem. So much then for that first section. Now our second section, which is going to take us through to the end of the portion I want to look at today, consists of three examples of memories and dreams. Memories and dreams. The first one from verse 8 to the end of chapter 2. She imagines her shepherd lover coming to visit her. And the woman says in verse 8, "The voice of my beloved, I can hear him. Behold, he comes, leaping upon the mountains, bounding over the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle. He's like a young stag. Behold, there he stands behind our wall." He's arrived now. "He's gazing in at the window. He's looking through the lattice. My beloved speaks and he says to me, 'Arise, my love, my fair one, come away.'" He invites her to go out with him, visit the fields, visit the vineyards, and wander hand in hand skipping through the fields. It's a very idyllic pastoral scene of two lovers going down there in the fields and flowers among the trees and vineyards. And he goes on in the rest of the chapter to describe how the winter is past, the rain is gone, the flowers appear, all is beautiful. All the essence there of a lovely love ballad. But she gets to the end of the song, of course, and she realises that it's all been only a dream. She is still alone, he is still in the fields, and she longs that he would come and take her to be with him. "My beloved," in verse 16, "is mine, I am his," she says. "He pastures his flock among the lilies. Until the day breathes and the shadows flee, turn, my beloved, be like a gazelle or a young stag upon the rugged mountains. Come and take me," she says, "as I have just dreamed." So much for the first of those three short dreams. The second one is again a short one in verses 1 to 5 of the next chapter. She dreamt about him one night in verse 1. "I was upon my bed. I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but I found him not. I called him, but he gave no answer. And so I said to myself," in verse 2, "I'll arise and go out into the city. I'll go into the streets and in the squares, and I will seek him whom my soul loves. And so I sought him, but I found him not." Isn't that a typical dream of a lover? Wanting to be with the person she loves, and the frustration of it all, not being able to find him. "The watchmen," in verse 3, "found me as they went about in the city. And I said to them, 'Have you seen him whom my soul loves?' But they hadn't. However," verse 4, "scarcely had I passed them, when I found him whom my soul loves. And so I held him, and I wouldn't let him go until I had brought him into my mother's house and into the chamber of her that conceived me." A very short, graphic picture of this lover looking for her man. And the third one is from verse 6, and it goes right through to the end of chapter 4 and spills over into the first verse of chapter 5. On this occasion, she is imagining her wedding day. And the arrival of her groom is like the arrival of a king. We have this princess and king picture once again. It's like a royal procession. It's like Solomon, in fact, in all his glory, coming along here to take his bride. And so she imagines here her wedding day in these magnificent pictures. Verse 6, she says, "What is that coming up from the wilderness like a column of smoke? Perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all the fragrant powders of the merchant? Behold, it's the litter of Solomon. About it are 60 mighty men of the mighty men of Israel, all girt with swords, expert in war." And so it goes on through the rest of the chapter as she describes the appearance of this great procession, her man coming to claim his bride. And in chapter 4, the man arrives, and he praises his bride in the most extravagant language. "Behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful," and here he goes again, "your eyes are doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats that moving down the slopes of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes." And so it goes on as he moves over the various parts of her body and describes her beauty. He summarizes it in verse 9 by saying, "You have ravished my heart, my sister, my bride." Indeed she has, if you read his descriptions of her beauty. He's utterly enraptured with this woman who is now to become his bride. He likens her in verse 12 to a fragrant garden. "A garden locked is my sister, my bride. A garden locked, a fountain sealed. Your shoots are an orchard of pomegranates with choice fruits. Henna, nard, saffron, calamus, cinnamon, frankincense, myrrh," and so it goes on. All the lovely spices. Again, they may not attract us. We would probably think in terms of the cosmetic section in some big department store. You walk through there and there's all these odours wafting through the air. We picture that as perfumes and fragrance and the like. Well, of course, in ancient times they didn't have myrrhs with all the girls spraying you with various types of perfume. But here he presents the same picture. His bride to him is this beautiful concentration of everything that is delightful and delectable. Well, says the girl in response in verse 16, she says, if you picture me then as this fragrant garden, I wish that the wind would come and blow upon my garden and carry its fragrance to you. Awake, O north wind, and come, O south wind, and blow upon my garden, and let its fragrance be wafted abroad, and let my beloved now come to his garden and eat its choicest fruits. Beautiful response, isn't it? As the bride now welcomes her groom to come and take her as his own. And the man doesn't need any encouraging. In verse 1 of the next chapter, he says, I'll come all right, I come to my garden. My sister, my bride, I'll gather my myrrh with my spices. I eat my honeycomb with my honey, I drink my wine with my milk. Again, further descriptions of her beauty, how he finds her luscious, how he finds her something that he is totally captivated by. And he now wants to come and make her his own. He accepts her invitation. Whereupon the friends in the end of verse 1 respond by announcing their blessing on the bridal couple. Eat, O friends, and drink, say all the guests. Drink deeply, O lovers. A dream of the wedding day and its consummation. Well, we'll leave it there for now, but you can see something of the excitement of love. There is, however, another side to the story, and that is the discipline of love. And we'll look at that in our next study.